Well, good evening and welcome to the sixth presentation in this, our 14th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, taking pictures at the back, Haiwan Wan, and our research instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of New Haven, Kentucky, in an area that's known as the Kentucky Knobs, Hill Country, not far from the Trappist Abbey of Gethsemane. It's an area where Catholic and Protestant cultures are juxtaposed, one with the other. He describes himself as the youngest of nine children in a Kentucky whiskey-making family of storytellers. He attended parochial schools and would later recall that his first publication was a sixth grade letter to the Louisville Courier Journal, published in 1964, in which he wrote that Kentucky's indifference to education would force him to leave, to which an anonymous respondent from his hometown replied that if he didn't like Kentucky, there were lots of roads out of town. He took one of those roads when he won a scholarship to Stanford and moved to San Francisco at the age of 17, just in time to experience the Cultural Revolution and anti-war protests of the early 1970s. He added an MFA in fiction from the famed Iowa Writers' Workshop, and he's since taught in the creative writing programs at San Francisco State University, Columbia University, New York University, Sarah Lawrence College, and the University of California at Davis. He's presently a professor of creative writing at the University of Arizona. His first novel, Crossing the River, which a critic noted described a headstrong Southern woman with a rebellious spirit, appeared in 1989. His second, Scissors, Paper, Rock, tells the story of a son with an AIDS diagnosis who returns to rural Kentucky to care for his dying father. Published in 1993, it was widely praised. Two works of nonfiction followed, an autobiographical memoir, Geography of the Heart, which won a Lambda Literary Award for biography, autobiography, and Keeping Faith, a skeptic's journey among Christian and Buddhist monks, which won both a Lambda Literary Award and a Kentucky Literary Award for creative nonfiction. Shorter works have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, the Swanee Review, Virginia Quarterly Review, and Harper's. And he's also written narrations for award-winning documentaries shown on PBS's Frontline. Most recently, his third novel, The Man Who Loved Birds, was published in 2016 by the University Press of Kentucky, which has also released new editions of his earlier novels. Just this month, Saraband Books has published a collection of his essays, Everywhere Home, A Life in Essays. And next year, Norton will publish his latest work of nonfiction. Please welcome one of Kentucky's most acclaimed writers, Fenton Johnson. Fenton.
Thank you, Brian, for that, and to Western Kentucky University for hosting me. I owe a great debt to Western. We all owe a great debt to Western for many reasons, but I was reminded today by Brian of the strength of the forensics department here, because my debate coach graduated from Western and got a degree in forensics from Western, and I was the boys' extemporaneous speaking champion of the state of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, thanks to Garland Blair. There's that debt. There is also the great debt to libraries, which I will come back to in just a second. This is the new book. By the way, I still own that postcard. I still have that postcard, which I view as my first piece of genuine fan mail. I have it in my archives. This is a new book, Everywhere Home, which is not officially out for another couple of weeks. I know that the book fair is going to have it, and I think Barnes & Noble is doing the books for the book fair, so it may be around here somewhere. I'm going to start by reading from it, and then I'll go to reading The Man Who Loved Birds, a section of that, and then if there's enough time to come back to reading a final essay out of Everywhere Home, A Life in Essays. I'm told these programs run about an hour. I will leave plenty of time for Q&A, and you know, we'll stick to that religiously, you might say. Here is some territory that I know that certain people in the audience will recognize very well, and it's really fun to read this to a collection of people who do recognize, who will recognize some of the landscape and the people in this piece. What's nice about a book called Everywhere Home is that there is an essay from each or one of the many places that I've lived over the years, so everywhere I go to read from it, I can choose from that particular geography, whether it's New York or Arizona or San Francisco or France. This you will recognize, called On Fire. I ordered my first drink at the Club 68 in Lebanon, Kentucky, 30 winding country miles east of my childhood home. The club was owned by Lebanese Christians, a long story, but the short version is that prosperous Anglos have always farmed out what they call vice to black people and rural people and newly arrived immigrants, people that Anglos can trash and persecute and imprison after they service the Anglo obsession with sin. The Irish, the Jews, the dark-skinned people, the hillbillies, and of course the queers, selling hooch or pot or heroin or meth or sex, thrown in the slammer after the goods are passed, but before the money changes hands. Fleeing violence abroad, these Lebanese Christians settle in Lebanon, a town of 5,000 which, some two centuries earlier, Presbyterian Scots had named after the Middle Eastern homeland of the Club 68's owners. An exile and an outlier, Hylene George, patriarch of the family, situated his nightclubs on the Chitlin Circuit, an assemblage of roadhouses scattered throughout the then segregated South, where African American musicians, en route from winters in New Orleans to summers in Chicago, performed in exchange for a room and a meal and a percentage at the door. Fresh from the multicultural patchwork of the Middle East, unburdened by the South's crushing obsession with race, George understood that white audiences would pay to see and hear black artists. He hired a black manager, who was Obi Slater. I had Chris look it up earlier today, courtesy of the web, but also courtesy of our fantastic library system. And I'm going to stop here to get my pitch for libraries. My mother was a librarian. I found, if you want to look up the following, Obi Slater wrote a very charming self-published memoir called From Wilson Pickett to Count Basie, was that it? And you can get it, I'm sure, through interlibrary loan. And this is my pitch to say that, you know, when it's tax time, it's that time of year, and I write that check with a grin and a smile on my face, because don't take for granted what it is that we have in our lives that our taxes are supporting. And the fact that you can go to your beautiful library and get these services from wonderful librarians, you know, I'm delighted personally to pay for that. Obi Slater was the black manager whom Hylene George hired, and he wrote the memoir about dealing with the people that I'm about to name. He hired a black manager, Obi Slater, and cross-programmed acts among his clubs, one all black, another all white, the third mixed, and the list of musicians he hired to play in this town is a roll call of mid-century American blues and jazz and rock and roll. B.B. King, Otis Redding, Jimi Hendrix en route from military service at Fort Campbell in western Kentucky to the formation of his own band in Cincinnati. Little Richard, Bo Diddley, Jackie Wilson, The Supremes, James Brown, Ray Charles, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Eddie James, Sam and Dave, Wilson Pickett, Percy Sledge, Eddie Floyd, Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, Junior Parker, Joe Tex, Laverne Baker, The Coasters, The Shirelles, The Platters, Count Basie, and Nat King Cole, not to mention a few white boys tagging along for the ride, among them Creedence Clearwater Revival, the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, and Steppenwolf. I had a friend who was 16, for those who know, Billy Frank Harned. I had a friend who was 16 and thus possessed of a driver's license and his parents' car. I had no idea who was playing that night of my first purchased drink and didn't much care. My friend and I were only looking to get drunk and, as was widely known, the clubs in Lebanon served alcohol to anyone tall enough to push a bill across the bar. The club, that's true, wasn't it? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. The club legally held maybe 300 people. That night there were easily 500. Under a ceiling 20 feet high, most of us were male. All of us were white. This was 1968, at the Club 68, on US Highway 68. I was 15 years old. On stage, Ike and Tina Turner and the Ikettes. I do not recall what Ike and Tina sang. What I recall is the discovery of desire. What Tina Turner did with her body, I hadn't conceived that anybody could do. As a gay boy, unaware that there were words to name what I wasn't in heat in the manner of most of the men around me. Nonetheless, Miss Turner taught me that evening that the body was something more than a suitcase for transporting the brain. Almost 50 years later, I, of the too vivid imagination, have to work to imagine how she could strut and entice and seduce 500 screaming, drunk Anglo country boys. That is what we call art, and she a true artist. Though, as I write that sentence, I speculate that she must have reveled in asserting her power, her black woman artist's power, in one of the few ways and places available to her. And so I encountered in art, her art, the catalyst for my lifelong project of dismantling Western civilization's separation of body from mind, heart from soul, in what was shown, not told, that evening at the Club 68 by Anna Mae Bullock, former Nutbush, Tennessee Baptist Church choir girl. No duality, no separation. Love your neighbor as yourself. We are all one in Christ Jesus. We are all one in desire. Driving home, my drunk friend got us lost and didn't get me to my parents' house until 4 a.m. For the first and last time, my mother was waiting up. In her expression, I understood that she had thought that I, her youngest son, was not going to be a hellraiser like her three previous sons, and she was sorely disappointed. Soon thereafter, segregation ended, at least officially, and doors opened for black artists to perform in first-class venues, even in the South. The Chitlin circuit faded into history. A few years after that, Tina left Ike. I doubt she ever again performed in a venue so humble. But she had awakened a force that was not to be denied, and though I'm not condoning that drunk drive home, and though I mourn all those fine men and women lost to AIDS, I have no regrets about my forays into the demimonde, the days and nights given over to seeking connection, communion with the gods, with God. Not long afterwards, I graduated from high school and went wandering, an ancient and exacting and honorable calling. Later in these pages, I will confess that I do not believe in time, that I do not believe in death. Looking out the window on a chill December day in my beloved Kentucky, my left ankle broken and in a cast from an accident involving a hibernating groundhog's hole in the woods surrounding the hermitage of the Trappist monk, mystic, and writer Thomas Merton, I find the sources of that observation so obvious as to need no explanation. The bare trees raised limbs, etched lines against the pale blue winter sky. Another 6 months, and these same trees will present a curtain of green. Only the smallest liberation of consciousness is required to understand me, the groundhog, the trees, and you as seamlessly unified and continuous elements of that same cycle of birth and death and rebirth. Nothing is absolute. Everything changes. Everything moves. Everything revolves. Everything flies and goes away. That's the Mexican artist Frida Kahlo, who knew whereof she spoke. Pain, pleasure, and death are no more than a process for existence. The revolutionary struggle in this process is a doorway open to intelligence, our intelligence, yours and mine. The smallest sprout, Walt Whitman writes, proves that there is no death. Eternal life, a process some call desire and some call God, and some have the wisdom to respect in silence. From the Sayings of the Desert Fathers, translated by Sister Benedicta Ward. Abba Lot went to see Abba Joseph and said to him, Abba, as far as I can, I say my little office, I fast a little, I pray and meditate, I live in peace, and, as far as I can, I purify my thoughts. What else can I do? Then the old man stood up and stretched his hands toward heaven. His fingers became like 10 lamps of fire, and he said to him, If you will, you can become all flame. In fiction and nonfiction, my lifelong subject has been the reintegration of desire in the sacred, a lifelong becoming of the flame. So that's the opening, that's the prologue, I guess you would say, to this collection of essays. And if we have time, I'll come back to read the closing essay before I take questions. So this book, A Man Loved Birds, was a very long time in the writing. It was 19, whatever year that it was, I was 17. I had graduated from high school. I had gotten a scholarship, as Brian mentioned, to go to California. And shortly before I left, in September, the state police took a local renegade named Charlie Stiles out and murdered him, shot him in a cornfield because they couldn't. He was related to everybody, and he made a kind of joke out of making fun of the police. And the police didn't like that, and finally they decided, as you might say, to take the law into their own hands. And they took him out and shot him. Everybody knew what had happened. There was no dispute about what had happened. And the silence that surrounded his murder, I'll call it that, was what sent me off to California. And I was it was 1971. I was young. I was, I guess, maybe naive. But I was really shocked by that. And I think I was right to be shocked by it. At the same time, around the same time, my town got there was a Pakistani woman doctor who moved to my hometown, which had not had a doctor in, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. And I thought, what must it be like to be a Pakistani Muslim woman doctor coming to a rural, solidly Roman Catholic town? And that always fascinated me, and those characters lived with me, that incident lived with me for years. If you think about it, you can ask me, and I will tell you about an extremely uncomfortable way in which it returned back into my life years later. I did the first feature length, I'd written some columns for the New York Times Magazine, but my first feature length story, they said, well, you know anything that's interesting that's going on? And I said, well, you know, everybody that I knew in Kentucky who used to grow tobacco is now growing pot. And they said, well, that sounds kind of interesting. Why don't you go down and look at that? So I went down and I talked to the pot growers. This was in 86, 87, maybe. And things were really tense then, because the draconian drug laws had just been implemented. People who were, 1 year they were growing literally an acre of pot within view of the state highway, and would get called into state, court, and the judge would say, no, $500, and next year you might put that pot a little farther from the field. The next year, with no warning, they were being given, their property was confiscated, they were given 21 years in federal prison with no possibility of parole, and that was the world that I unknowingly walked into, and so things were really tense. Those people wouldn't have talked to me, I'm sure, except that I was able to establish local connections. I was from there. Everybody knew my family. Everybody had known my father. And so I guarded all of I had some just amazing, fantastic conversations with people who opened up to me once they trusted me. And I kept, I used some of that material, but of course very little for the magazine piece. And I kept it all, and a lot of those conversations I quote as they're just directly lifted as the dialogue in with the pot growers who feature in this book, which is I made the woman a Bengali woman doctor. I've always been interested, as Brian hinted at in his introduction, growing up with a Protestant mother who had converted to Catholicism. I was always interested in the butting up against each other of religious traditions. And my first novel had a Protestant woman who marries into a Catholic community. And for this novel, I thought I really wanted to jump, you know, if you're going to jump off a 50-foot cliff, why not jump off a 500-foot cliff? And I decided that Islam was a Judaic tradition. It was out of the same tradition as Christianity, and originally tracing itself back to the Jews. And I wanted to go as far away from Christianity as I could, and I'd always been kind of interested in Hinduism, and so I decided to make her a Bengali. And I went, and I always, for some reason, I can't really put a finger to, I'd always been fascinated with Calcutta. And so I went and lived in Calcutta for a month to try to figure out who she was. So the three main characters really are drawn from the books that I had written up to that point, one of whom is a Trappist monk. I was named after one of the Trappist monks at the Abbey of Gethsemane and have come to know them well, some of them well. One of the characters is a Trappist monk named Brother Flavian. Another character is a Bengali woman doctor who has immigrated to the United States under a program that may still exist, although who knows in the current environment, in which if you came to this country and got your medical training here and you agreed to do your service in an underserved area, you could get a green card. And in fact, that is what brought the doctor to my hometown in New Haven. And so that, under that, that is the pretext I give her for ending up in this fictional small town novel. Her name is Meena Chatterjee. And the third character is a renegade outlaw, pot-growing outlaw named Johnny Fay. And the passages that I'm going to read, I'm only going to read a short passage. I'd like to read it. In the course of a book, you set yourself certain challenges and you try to meet them in crossing the river. And when I originally thought that the person, Holly Tucker, on our panel tomorrow was the country music singer, I actually went and listened to some of her music because I thought, and I'm going to be on a panel with her. I was going to turn to her and say, you know, I set myself the challenge in crossing the river of writing a good country music song and folding it into the book, and I failed. I tried and tried and tried, and finally I wrote my way around it, because it's tough to write a really good country music song. For this book, I decided that I wanted to write a polemic, a speech that Johnny Fay would give. I'll tell you up front, and I'll read the speech that he gives. He's on trial. He's been brought to trial for growing pot, and the county attorney has given his speech to convict, and this is Johnny Fay's speech in his defense. He argues he won't have an attorney, he won't have a lawyer, won't have anything to do with lawyers. He gives his own defense, and this is that speech. And I don't think you need to know anything more than that, other than that the county attorney's name is Harry Vitch. This is Johnny Fay speaking. I'm brought before this court. Oh, by the way, yeah, one thing I will say. When I've read this in California and New York places, urban places, people have said that they feel that the pot grower couldn't be as intelligent and as articulate as this guy is. And I just think, you know, you city people, you really assume that all smart people go to college, and that people who don't go to college aren't smart. And you know, the people that I have talked to, they have a very sophisticated understanding of economics, of their situation in the world, extremely articulate. That's my defense of China today. I'm brought before this court accused of the crime of being a small farmer, Johnny Fay said. Objection, Your Honor, Harry Vetch, the county attorney said. The accused is brought before this court for the very specific felony offense of growing Class 1 drugs in quantities intended for sale. None of Mr. Fay's comments are germane to the crime that is the subject of this trial. The judge looked over her glasses at the county attorney. I concede your point, Mr. Vetch, but Mr. Johnny Fay has a way, as we know, of telling a story. I'm interested in where he is leading us with this train of thought. But precedent requires, Vetch said. Mr. Vetch, I concern myself as much with justice as with legal precedent, an attitude I recommend to the jury, if not always shared by my colleagues, but in my view, I'm well within the spirit, if not the letter of the law. Please, Mr. Johnny Fay, please proceed, though in consideration of our collective desire to spend our golden years somewhere other than in this courtroom, I ask you to make your point with some efficiency, much as I know that to be a challenge. Thank you, ma'am, Your Honor, Johnny Fay said. I am brought before this court for the crime of being a small farmer. The crop I'm accused of growing was grown by our grandparents and their parents before them and was used in everything from the weaving of burlap and rope up to and including a smoke to take care of the aches and pains of old age. They built roads, they carved paths through the wilderness to convey the selfsame crop to market. That's true, you know, the first public roads built in Kentucky were for the purpose of conveying the hemp crop to market. 1812, something like that. Then one year, a large corporation, DuPont, if you want to know, figures out how to make a product that serves some of the same purposes, except that it is inferior in every way. It frays faster and gives out sooner. It's weaker. You can't wear the clothes you make from it without burning up in your own skin. Smoking it is a poor way to meet your maker. This newfangled product is inferior in every way except this one. You and I can't make it or grow it. It's made from with oil brought from afar, extracted from deep inside the bowels of the earth. And in one of those great mysteries of what the lawyer educated in the big city you have never seen and do not want to visit called civilization, in the very next year after this large corporation obtains a patent for this inferior product, made with oil taken from below the sands of the Arabs, a patent for nylon to give it a name, in the very next year our government makes it a crime to produce the superior product that our grandparents could and did grow and harvest. I don't know what to make of this remarkable coincidence. I'm just pointing it out for your consideration. I would like to stay on the land. You know what happens to me, to people like me, when we go to the big city. We live on the streets because we can't hold down a city-type job and we can't figure out how to live in a city-type house, where your neighbors look through your windows, if you got windows, and where the landlord is ever ready to put you out on the pavement. Enough living on the streets and we start getting a little crazy and pretty soon we start doing drugs, hard drugs, and that makes us more crazy. And pretty soon we are a danger to our neighbors and ourselves. To send me to the city would be a bad idea all around. Bad for the city and definitely bad for me. But if I'm to stay in this place, I have only one way to afford to be true to my nature, and that is to be a small, independent, ornery son of a bitch farmer. I do it good. In the way that the hawk soars and the bee gathers honey, it is in my nature to dig in the dirt. Now the lawyer educated in the big city proposes to bring more envy and more wanting into your homes and hearts. He wants us to go looking at those big houses he is building on his mowed golf course and say, why can't I have that? I work just as hard, maybe harder than the folks that live in them big houses. And the next thing you know, we're raising prices at the store or charging more to look under the hood of your car because we have agreed to bow down to the boot. We, you and me, have agreed that making money is our first priority. Why help your neighbor put a roof on his house when you can charge him money for your time? Why take care of your old folks or your kids at home when you can pay somebody else to do it for you so you can use that time to make more money, which you are going to have to make if you are going to keep up that big brick house on the golf course and payments through the bank, which is what really owns you in your house? The county attorney has argued that he is a practical man and that putting me in jail is the practical solution to the problem that is me. The way I look at it, he is the all-time dreamer in his rosy-eyed argument that the rich getting richer is magically going to make us poor get richer too. The rich get richer on the backs of the poor, and their main way of getting richer is to wring more blood out of us turnips. And if we're stupid enough to go along without a fight, then we deserve to have our blood wrung. The county attorney would have you believe that if each of us is as greedy as he wants, then all of us are going to get rich. I ask you to think about what would happen among your family and friends if each of you set out to do your own thing and screw your brother and father and sister and mother and neighbor. And then I ask you to tell me just how the world is any different between strangers than it is between friends and family. What you are facing, I want to suggest to you that you have a higher authority right at hand to consult you, to tell you what's right, to consult to tell you what's right. Johnny Fay pointed to his heart. Whose law is it that the county attorney is serving and asking you to put me in jail? Is it the law that binds mother to father and son and mother and father to son and daughter, sister to sister, brother to brother, neighbor to neighbor, the law of love that binds us all to each other and to the stranger? Or is it the law that sets each of these against each other and makes us all slaves to the rich people in the big city where the county attorney went to learn how to do just that? At one time that law forbid us to make whiskey, now it makes money from us doing that very thing. Now it forbids us from growing hemp and wants to throw us in jail until such time as it figures out how to make money off of that operation. As soon as it changes its mind on that point, it will figure out some other way to make criminals out of the poor. You all know I served this nation. He was a Vietnam vet. I'm not proud of what I did, but when duty called, I gave my best. Now the lawyer calls me the enemy of the state and the people, when all I want is to be left in peace. I tend to my garden and to my mother and my friends, and I would give the shirt off of my back to a stranger who needed it, and that is about as much of life as I can handle. You can put me in jail if you want, but you won't be putting me in a room smaller than the one I already live in, nor serving me food any plainer than what I already eat, and you can't make me poorer than I already am because my riches are not made of stuff. I appreciate your time and your service. So that's Johnny Fay's speech, which is largely based in and borrowed from the writings of your friend and mine, Jesus. I'll close by reading a last passage. I'll read this last passage, and then I will see if you all have any questions. Where does it start? No, there it starts. Every summer, about the beginning of August, it's April, but think of this, when August comes, Derry arrives as a chapter title borrowed from your friend and mine, William Faulkner. Light in August. We'll come to that. Every summer, around the beginning of August, a day arrives when I'm walking along in mid-afternoon, and I realize the light has slipped. Its angle is no longer that of high summer, high and hammering. Light that for the last couple of months I've come to take for granted, in my too human fashion, as the way things will always be. Summer will never end. No one I love will ever die. Now the angling light signals that the endless summer is ending. In fact, I and everyone I love will die. The only question is, who will be first to reach the finish line? And yet I see I have indulged in a commonplace misperception, since properly understood, there is no finish line. We are creatures of light, sentient bundles of the energy moving through the universe. It is of us as we are of it. There is no death. There is only process, changing from one form to another. Through some Cartesian sleight of hand, the brain refuses to perceive this. Instead, it cunningly divides the world into dualities. There's a little dab of brain, I'm told, given over to setting boundaries. This is where I end. This is where you begin. Me, you, us, them, male, female, light, dark, beginning, end, life, death. No doubt these illusions are, or were, necessary for our survival, no matter that they're the basis for murder and mayhem and our self-centered understanding of death as now you see us, now you don't. In fact, death is only another milepost in the never-ending becoming of what is. Ask your dog. She'll agree. Look to the wag in her tail. You don't see her moping about impending doom. In this particular early August, I noticed a slipping light on a walk rendered poignant by the tension of unrequited love. Denied an outlet for my passion, I offered my companion the observation that if I believed in death, I'd kill myself. "What do you mean?" he asked, no doubt casting an uneasy glance at the penknife dangling from my backpack. "All that loss," I answered, "all that grief. Who could stand it if he really believed death to be the finish line? "Not me. I take great affirmation and good cheer, knowing we're light from light, true gods from true gods, one form of energy changing into another, until billions of years hence, when in the entropy of time, all our colors will merge and melt into a uniformly still gray, the gray of the paintings that hang in the Rothko Chapel in Houston." Under the auspices of Harper's Magazine, I once moderated a debate held in that chapel. The subject at hand was faith and reason, as false a duality as light and dark, or male and female, or life and death. But one thing had led to another, and here we were, with the Pulitzer-winning novelist Marilynne Robinson representing faith, and the Nobel-winning physicist Steven Weinberg representing reason, and me wondering how I'd gotten myself from my childhood in the Knobs into refereeing such august company. I chose the Rothko Chapel as our venue. I actually chose it because Steven Weinberg, being a Nobel winner, refused to change planes. He said Harper's would not let me pay people, and Steven Weinberg would not change planes, so it had to be somewhere that was within a, you could fly from Austin without changing planes, and Marilynne Robinson, being a mere humanist, would change planes, so she came from Iowa City through Chicago to Houston. Anyway, I chose the Rothko Chapel as our venue a mistake. It features works by Mark Rothko, painted in the decade before he took his life in 1970. Vast lozenges of a smooth, even gray, surrounded by halos of an almost indiscernibly darker gray, hung against the lighter gray of the walls. Their enveloping gray stillness prompts not debate, but contemplation. They demand that we sit down, shut up, still ourselves to the essence of being, the unbearable gray lightness of being. Robinson burned with quiet passion. Weinberg might be the most articulate man with whom I have had the honor of conversing, as was evidenced in that day's debate when he, the combative atheist, set forth the case for faith and then argued with himself while the contemplative Robinson listened. But we're not yet at the debate. We've just walked into the chapel and we're spending a moment looking at Rothko's paintings. Weinberg shook his head. "I love abstract art," he said. "I collect abstract art, but I just don't get Rothko. What is it with these great blobs of gray?" The most delicate of pauses ensued before Robinson said quietly, "It's the moment before creation." I would have been happy to have ended the debate right there, since to my mind the exchange said all that needed to be said about the debater's different understandings of the way things are. In the first 3 minutes, Weinberg wrote, "Even when physicists have gone as far as they can go, there seems to be an irreducible mystery that science will not eliminate." Robinson, the contemplative, grasped what he, the scientist, had not perceived. Stories in art are our means of putting our hearts around the irreducible mystery. Rothko had painted that mystery a few years before he plunged in. To reunify the parts of our broken selves is, it seems to me, to make a commitment to become a whole person, a holy person, a vocation that each of us must discern and fulfill in our particular ways. The good news is that, as Rabbi Menachem of Kotsk wrote, there is nothing so whole as a broken heart. Reading and writing are or can be the glue, one means we use to patch ourselves together. They have served that purpose for me. Among the most brilliant of book titles is William Faulkner's Light in August, a novel contained in a phrase. "Memory believes before knowing remembers," Faulkner wrote, "believes longer than recollects, longer than knowing even wonders." To read or write poetry or prose is to lay claim to your citizenship among the people of faith. Every reading, every writing is an act of faith. Everything is always, as my friend Barry says, most especially us, and most especially memory. And before you ask what he'd been smoking, take a walk at eventide in the light in August, the month of plenitude and of loss. So I'll stop there, and thank you all for coming. And we have about 15 minutes for questions. I don't know if anybody's got a question. Yeah, speak.
You mentioned that you went to Calcutta and spent a month there developing the character of the Bengali doctor. Have you often traveled to places that you've never been before just to develop a character?
Often might be an overstatement, yeah. It's kind of a myth that fiction gets made up from scratch. I don't know any writer who doesn't do research. Now, having said that, we had some discussion earlier with supper table about this notion that you can't write about something unless you actually literally have experienced it. And there are so many examples of writers who have written brilliant, moving, wonderful books that are from the points of view of people who are radically different from their, a Bengali woman doctor. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do was to challenge myself to see if I could manage to occupy that person, that persona, and I leave it to the reader to decide. I've been very happy with the University of Kentucky Press. The book had a troubled history toward publication because I sent it out. I happened to finish it in 2009 at the very bottom of the market. Nobody was buying anything. Publishers had overstocked. They had too many books that they had already bought. And once you only have one chance with a New York house, you can, or any house, you send it once, and if somebody says no, forget about taking it back there, no matter how much they like it. But I was happy to see that the editor who came closest to taking it is a Bengali editor Rupert Murdoch, Harper, at HarperCollins. Yeah. That was nice, and I didn't need to do research into the monastery. And, the pot piece I'd written years before, Keeping Faith, is certainly a seriously researched book. Many of the essays in this book, which go from, pretty much every landscape that I've lived in, have, they have a deep research behind them. I like to, I'll just tell this story instead of reading it, but it's in the book. It's a lost leader to get you to buy the book whenever it comes out. So some of you probably know that it's in an essay called Shrines and Wonders, in which I look at our need to set up these, to have these places that we make pilgrimages to where these events happen, which we know are, to ask the question of whether Jesus really rose from the dead or whether Durga had 10 arms is to ask the wrong question. These are koans, as you say, in Buddhism. They're intended to challenge us to liberate ourselves from our grabby reason that wants everything to make sense. And whoever said the universe had to make sense to us? I mean, Steven Weinberg would say that. At any rate, the opening of that chapter is the story of the cabin at the Lincoln Memorial, National Monument in outside Pottenville, where when I was growing up, we were told that was the cabin in which Lincoln was born. And even then I thought, how did they fit in there? I know they were living on the frontier. So it turns out that the story of the cabin gets more, it's so layered that it would take a French semiotician to work it out. So this enterprising businessman found logs on what was, we do sort of know that's the Lincoln property because the sinking spring is there and it's such a dramatic landmark that they would have located the house somewhere close to the sinking spring, and so the house must have been, the cabin must have been within 50 yards. You don't want to carry water any farther than you have to. But he found logs at that site, which he put together and called it Lincoln's Boyhood, Lincoln, the Birthplace Cabin, which he transported around the country to various state fairs and county fairs, making money as, you know, charging people to see the cabin. After, this was after Lincoln was assassinated, charging money to see the cabin in which Lincoln was born. And each time it was assembled and reassembled, it lost a few inches of its, you know. And after about 10 years, the interest wasn't there anymore, so they put the logs in storage. So the calendar pages flip past, it's 1910 or thereabouts, and a committee of people say, we can't let the Lincoln's cabin rot into ruin. So the Lincoln penny was minted in order to raise money from America's children to build a suitable monument for the cabin. So they bring it out of storage, they put it together, and it turns out they hired John Russell Pope, who the leading neoclassical architect of the day, who designed the Jefferson Memorial and the National Archives on the Mall in Washington. They hired him to design the building. And he, Shrines and Wonders, he was designing a building for the cabin of his imagination. He never thought to actually measure the cabin that he was building for. And so it's very grand. If you've been there, you know, it's numerology, one step for every year of Lincoln's life, 13 pillars for the original colonies, you know, blah, blah, blah. But when they finished it, they found that the room that he had designed for the cabin was too small to hold the cabin. So they lopped off another 2 feet of the cabin in order to get it to fit into the room. So, and here's the kicker that I didn't know until about, until right when I was writing this book, about a year ago. The same businessman went to found the cabin in which Jefferson Davis was born and put that together and had it traveling around the country in tandem with the Lincoln cabin. And when they were put in storage, the Lincoln logs and the Davis logs got mixed up together. So when you go there to see the cabin, you're seeing, and they carbon dated logs now, and the oldest log dates to 1840. So, you know, so when you go there, you're seeing this monument to a combination of capitalism's need to make money off of our need to imagine a past in which we can believe. It's a you know, and what I want, of course, what we all want, we want the National Park Service to tell that story, because that's so much more interesting than to say. I mean, it is true, you can see the story evolve. When we were kids, you get a brochure, this is where Lincoln was born. And then enough people died, and you'd get a brochure, and it said, the cabin where Lincoln is said to have been. And then a few more years passed, the cabin where Lincoln was traditionally held to be born. And today, the website says, a cabin stands as a symbol of the cabin. So, anyway. Another question? Do we have another question? Yes.
So why did you choose to make your character from a different country, from Bangladesh rather than from Pakistan? Or was the doctor that came from East Pakistan that became Bangladesh in real life?
She did come from East Pakistan. And in fact, the story of her background, which, some people, Wendell Berry's wife said that the book was hard to read because Calcutta is a hard, hard, hard place. And I have no regret about going there. I've thought about going back there again. It was built by the British, of course. It's like if you've been to London, take London, set it down in the tropics. You know, broad boulevards, brick Victorian, huge brick Victorian, and fantastically decayed. And whole villages, Calcutta's, I spoke to a woman who leads a dance troupe in San Francisco before I went there, who had taught there, and she taught all over the world, and she said, Calcutta is the hardest place that I've ever been, and if I could go back there tomorrow, I would. And she said that 2 days after she brought her dance troupe there, they did a movement exercise in which they let go of every assumption about how the world is supposed to work. Because she said, we won't get through another month here if we hold on to anything, any assumption about how the world is supposed to work. And 2 days after I got to Calcutta, I sat in my little monastic cell where I was staying, and I said, we're going to do that exercise. You know, you cannot let go. You cannot hold on to anything you believe about how the world is supposed to work, because you're not going to be able to stay here for this to happen. But to answer your question, my father said of me when I was 8, and he did not mean it as a compliment, given 100 ways to do something, I would always choose to do the hardest. And Hinduism was farther from Christianity than Islam, and I was more interested in Hinduism. I went at the time of year of Durga Puja, which has to be the world's most incredible, fantastic, amazing, unbelievable festival, when people who have nothing give everything that they don't own. They give even their lives to have this enormous party for 10 days, which is fueled by no drugs, no alcohol that I could perceive, no one drinks. And everybody is in the streets 24/7 for 10 days having a party. And it is, you know, do a search for images of Durga Puja, D-U-R-G-A-P-U-G-A. It's the Durga is the patroness of the city of Calcutta. And it was fantastic. It was amazing. So there are glances at that throughout the book. And she comes to America because her family she's an orphan. Her parents send her into West Bengal during the very impossibly brutal war of 1971, and she never sees them again. And her mother sews rubies into the hem of her dress, and she uses those to buy her passport. There's a section in the book that's kind of uneerily appropriate to today's immigration issues, because she doesn't have any papers. There's no record of her birth. And she's used that money to buy her way into the green card. And she confronts the attorney about, what would have happened to me had I not had those rubies sewn into the hem of my dress. And so thank you for the question. Maybe another question. I think we have time for maybe one more. Yeah, speak.
A question about memoir, and it's not on the books, I guess, that you've been reading from, but I really enjoyed Skeptic's Journey, and I don't know how many years ago that was completed, but as you look back on your memoir, how do you feel about your... Was it well written? Was it true? Or has it changed the way that you see yourself now? I don't know that I made a coherent question, but...
Well, I'll repeat your question back to you, and you can tell me if it's something like what you had in mind, which is that in what ways does the writing of memoir reflect reality, which is, as Nabokov said, the only word that always to have quotation marks around it, reality. And how has the process of writing changed me? And I'll tell a little anecdote. In the writing of Geography of the Heart, the early 1990s, I wanted to rail at Ronald Reagan for not authorizing research sooner. I wanted to rail at the medical system in the United States. I wanted whatever. And I kept writing these long political diatribes. And finally, I said to myself, the only thing I've ever typed and put up above my desk, I typed, just tell the damn story. Because the story carries its power. The more you can get out of the way of the story and let the story come through, the more you're going to be able to touch a reader. And that was the best advice that I had ever given to myself as a writer. Maybe I have learned from that. I can't imagine at this point myself, writing and being and reading, they're all bound up with each other. They're integral to each other, and they have made me who I am. I suggest that everybody in the room who has any inclination to put fingers to keyboard or pen to paper, challenge yourself to, some of the various prompts that I give to my students. Write the first lesson in moral instruction that you can ever remember seeing, write, hearing. Write some of those stories down, and see what that, and then work with them, massage them, you know, try to make them. The interesting thing about writing for publication, which you do not recommend to, it's a different thing entirely. But nonetheless, writing so that you can touch other people does require you to submit to a kind of discipline that is the discipline of the woodworker who wants to make a piece of furniture that somebody can actually sit in or look at and enjoy looking at, the discipline of the cook who wants to make a cake that everybody can look at and enjoy and taste good. It's the discipline of the sculptor, it's the discipline of the dancer. Some kind of, the analogy that I use, and I think it would be a nice place to end because I like it a lot, and I would not have come by it except for my writing. My writing has taught me so much that I didn't know. I wasn't smart enough to write any of those books, and I go back and look at them and say, who was that person? And in that sense, I think that does answer your question. At any rate, I came up once with, it's in Geography of the Heart, I think, or maybe Keeping Faith, I don't remember. Life is like water. It takes the shape of the vessel into which it is poured. Remove the vessel and it's lost. And writing has been, for me, figuring out a way of shaping a vessel in which to pour that experience. And whatever you can do to find a vessel, for to create a vessel, because you need a vessel. It needs a form. It needs a, that's what we do. That's what human beings do, is we tell stories and we shape that reality, what our memories, our histories, our stories. Whatever you can do to make that happen is it's going to make you, the very worst thing that is going to happen is that you're going to make yourself into a better person, and that your survivors are going to find out a lot of scandalous material that they maybe didn't want to know about. You know, there's something to be said for that, too. Let me finish by saying, this book is dedicated to my sister, Laura Johnson Boone, and all people who, as I say of her, live in service to other people. I'll end with a thank you to my sister, Nancy Derry, who was here, and my family. Who is it? A Russian writer, Chekhov, I don't know, says, when the writer is born into the family, that's the end of the family. And my family has been enormously patient. And with nobody has ever said to me, and I've consulted them on occasion, no one has ever said to me, don't write that. Nobody has ever said to me, and I've ventured into some racy territory, and they have always been very supportive. So that's the great good news of having that particular kind of family. And it's I'll close by saying thanks again to Western. It's such a delight to be back in wonderful Kentucky. It's also particularly great to be down here. I've never been invited to speak in the southern or western part of the state, and I'm really glad that that has happened, and I really appreciate Brian and the library staff and Western for making that possible. And thank you all for coming.